I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, and welcome to Jokes with Mark Simmons, the podcast where I chat to another comedian about jokes and routines and gags they can't get to work. As always, I am joined by producer Joel.
Hello.
On the other end of the line, there he
That's
is.
That's me.
That's him. Joel, what's happening? How's your lockdown?
Oh, 3 more weeks.
It's going to be more than that, weeks. Mate.
3 more weeks.
It's going to be more than that. I tried to write a joke about that earlier, but I couldn't because of language. Would you like to hear about it, Joe?
Of course.
I saw someone put something about lift restrictions, about they're not going to lift restrictions. And I thought, yep, there's a joke there about lift restrictions, i.e. just take the stairs, or like in a fire, that's, you're not allowed to use a lift, that's a lift restriction, isn't it? But language wise you can't lead into lift restrictions in the right way to make it work both sides of the joke, because you it's like a you say you would have to lift restrictions, that doesn't make sense with actual lift restrictions, and you can't start the sentence with lift restrictions because it wouldn't make sense the other side. So, backed myself into a corner with that joke. But I thought, you know, that's what people are tuning in for, to hear this sort of stuff, aren't they?
Hello? Hello?
Hello, Joe? Are you there, Joe? Joe? Unbelievable. I'm going to keep it running and hope that Joe will come back to me. I'm just going to find his number. We are now calling Joel, producer Joel. He should answer in a second. And he's answered.
What happened there?
I don't know. Have you kept recording?
Yep.
Yeah, me too.
Lift restrictions.
Yeah. I don't know how much you missed of that, Joel, but it doesn't matter because let's crack on. Anything else happening? I've just started Westworld.
No, nothing happening for me, Mark.
No, we're not doing that bit yet. I just told you, Joel, I've started watching Westworld. Have you seen it?
Oh, I watched the first series, I think.
Yeah, I'm watching it.
I think it's good.
Yeah, it is good. Yeah, it's high concept, isn't it, Joel?
It is high concept.
Yeah, it's good. I like it. That's about it, really.
Who wrote the book? Is it the same guy that wrote Jurassic Park?
Yeah.
Michael Crichton, is that right?
Why not? You know what? Interesting to say that, because I actually made the point to my girlfriend that it's very much like Jurassic Park in a lot, really, because it is a park, for one.
Yep.
But they're robots instead of dinosaurs.
Yeah.
I haven't got too far in yet, but I'm guessing something goes wrong with those robots and they become a threat to humans, possibly.
Yeah.
And there's an old bloke, like quite a respected old bloke in acting world, who's in charge of making it in both films.
Yeah.
There you go. Bit of movie news and TV news there for you. Bet you're so glad you tuned in. This week we have got Stuart Goldsmith, comedian and podcaster from that podcast, Comedians Comedian Podcast.
Podcast royalty, isn't he?
Podcast royalty, Stuart Goldsmith is here in the flesh on the end of the line. Let's just get into it, shall we, Joe?
Yeah.
Here he is. So how's your lockdown?
It's good. I mean, with all respect to the dead and dying, I'm having the time of my life. I'm at home all the time. I'm seeing my children every day. I'm doing every morning. Yeah. I'm doing every bedtime and bath time.
You're up early. You're up early. This is the earliest one of these I've done.
I've been up for 5 hours.
Yeah. When you messaged, I was like, oh yeah, 11. That's fine. I'm really productive on lockdown. And I was got up early. I was like, oh, I need a coffee. I need a shower.
Yeah.
And then we're doing it by Zoom, so you can see me. I was like, I've got to put clothes on.
You're normally naked during the podcast. That really puts a different spin on it.
Yeah. I'm one of those people that hacks into Zoom. What was it that you told me a minute ago that people, so you got hacked?
Yeah, got trolled. Yeah. The reason I'm so chipper is I've been spending the last month kind of trying to invent things online, invent ways of doing comedy. Like there's two methods of hunting, as you know, Mark. You can either, like the predators use in the wild, you can either sit and wait for food to come along and snatch it, or you can go out and try and find food. And I'm definitely the second type. So rather than waiting for someone to invent how online gigs work, I'm like, I'm going to bloody invent how online gigs work. So I've been incredibly busy for the last month. And I've been doing numerous experiments. And in one of the experiments, we had maybe 12 people in the room and I was doing a gig to them, or like hosting a gig to them, in an attempt to create a version of an online stand-up gig where the performer isn't just howling into the void, but is performing to live human faces that you can see and hear reacting, right? It's just world-changing. It's brilliant. World-changing. If your world is usually the M4, then it changes your own personal world. What I mean is, it's insignificant and meaningless. But during one of those experiments, I, as an experiment, put the Zoom login and password on Twitter, because I thought we can fit a few more people in here. It'd be great if anyone following me just jumps on it. And even if we just get 5 more people, we can see if it works with 17 people rather than 12. And I learnt that there are trolls, and I'm assuming what they do is Google the terms Zoom and password in order to hoover up, you know, and just go, oh, there's one, I'll get me dick out. And so we had this elderly man stroking it. Jacking it, frankly.
What, live?
Yeah, he had a webcam on him, and he was clearly watching porn with a webcam on him. And suddenly he saw it. He's like a flasher. He saw all of our faces, and he was jacking it. Yeah, and so we're like, whoa, hello, get rid of this guy. But of course, the people that are into it, then shortly afterwards, it happened again. Like there was another, but by that time we were prepared for it. It was like, let's let this guy in. We don't recognize his name, but maybe he's a fan on Twitter or something. So we admitted him from the waiting room to the main thing. And then he changed the settings and took over the screen share and started showing granny porn.
Fucking hell, wow. It's not all bad then.
It's not all bad. I was just going to say, you had a lovely little pause and a sort of low murmur. Fucking hell. And describe, where can you find stuff like that, Stu?
Well, that is crazy. That's mad. So it's like, so your platform has changed the world for comedians and people to watch comedy, but also the people that can't go out flashing.
Yep. 100%. Yeah. I mean, they're out there, and it must be, you know, if you're a grimy perv who likes upsetting people with your schlong, then this is what a time to be alive. Everyone's in. Everyone's in, and a load of people are experimenting with technology they don't understand.
Oh, that's crazy. Yeah, I've heard a lot about Zoom.
Yeah.
People hacking it and stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's there's all sorts
of
fun,
isn't it? It's a story, isn't it? It's a story.
Yeah, absolutely. This is it. This is going to be comedy 20 years from now. Everyone will be going, oh, yeah, so I got flashed. Like, all stories will take place on Zoom. You know, you can tell comics now. You know,
every time they do a story about getting heckled, it's just going to be a guy stroking it to them.
Well, you know, you can tell comics now. You can tell which comics can drive, because people have either got anecdotes about service stations and cars, or they've got anecdotes about train stations. And you're like, this guy drives, this guy doesn't, this guy occasionally gets a lift. I'm using guy in a non-gendered way there. So I think in future, it'll be a case of like, what did you do during the great pandemic? I did mostly Skype gigs. I've got anecdotes about, you know, getting heckled on Zoom or what have you. I was mostly live streaming all my materials about it. So one time I was on Instagram and this guy said the funniest thing I've ever seen. You know, someone commented and I hit like, and honestly, we fell about.
So you saying about experimenting, that's, I was going to talk to you about that anyway, because You started experimenting with how to generate material, right?
So yes.
So you do a different show every day in Edinburgh, and everything was different.
It was different every day. It wasn't a completely new thing. I wasn't doing the Tommy Tiernan. I'm attracted to that idea of going out there and trying to say nothing that you've ever said before. That's like the next level. Oh, well, that's probably a good few levels above. Like, I love the idea of that. I'm scared of it, but I do love the idea of it. But so what I was doing, I did a show called Primer, in which I had a screen with maybe 50 or 60 words on it, little bits of sentences, basically just a sort of physical, a large version of writing a few notes on the back of your hand.
Right.
And I put that up so it was visible to the audience as well. And I do jokes about the fact of it, which was quite a nice way to kind of warm up. I've never, ever used props on stage or any kind of visual or any kind of special effect or theatricality or effort. I've never made an effort of any kind. And I once had a blackout in my last tour, but that was absolutely the limit. This was like a big screen with all the words on it. So I would do sort of introductory jokes about how it worked. And what it was really good for, because the words would, I would change, I would turn over stuff, I'd go that bit. As soon as something really worked, I'd kind of put it in a different section on the screen that was a box of like, if you're really struggling, do this, but it's up and running. So really you should be pushing yourself to do the brand new stuff that you don't know what the hell you're talking about. Because what I wanted to do was push myself into, well, two things. One, I wanted to just start massively turning over stuff and learn to be funnier than my material. Do you mean like I want to just be funny because I'm talking, so it's funny because it's me. That's what I'm aiming for. Lofty goal. But also what it means is I'm never struggling to remember something, because struggling to remember something is a deeply uncreative place for me. Actually having the stuff written on you, really it'd be, I realised afterwards what I could have done is put it behind the audience like a sort of massive cue card. But even then, there'd be some element of subterfuge, whereas I quite like the balls out. A lot of squinting. I really like the kind of brassy, that's the stuff, I don't know the stuff, let's see what happens. And I think, you know, whether or not that's... I came away from Edinburgh having had the time of my life. It was so creative and fun, and it was exactly what that festival is supposed to be. Yeah. And I came away with this really big question of, like, do I take the findings of that experiment, do I go, great, that's how I build a show now I go off and build the show, or is that my show now? Because they're two radically different ways of doing it. The second one is never going to get on live at the Apollo. No one's going to, you know, see your thing with a screen and, oh, he does this weird thing where he doesn't really know what the fuck he's doing. But I honestly came out of it going, I love new material. I love, you know, every comic's best time on stage is when a brand new bit works and has legs. Mm. That's the crack, right? That's the gold dust. And so given that we can all do precisely what we want and we're just here to do what we want, why do we participate in this kind of, it's not a lie, but it's like this sort of group hallucination that progression is a thing and that the industry is a thing and that you have to do a certain sort of thing. Most of the acts I'm excited to go and see, really excited. I love a Rory Scovell or a Mike Birbiglia, you know, a perfect finely tuned show with loads of risk within it and brilliant jokes. But a lot of the time I they're the rarities, I think, within stand-up. A lot of the time I want to see Phil Kay, I want to see Russell Hicks, thank you. Phil Kay, Russell Hicks, Terry Alderton. And I also love kind of Lucy Pearman and sort of, you know, Spencer Jones kind of weirdness. But I love people just like Tarzan or Jane leaping. No, Tarzan, the one with the abilities, the specific abilities. I love to see people leap and not know whether they're going to catch the next vine or not. I love that. And I love doing that. So why am I trying to confine that really electrifying state on stage into now I'll do the tidy version of the brilliant thing? Why does anything need to be finished? Why can't I do work in progress for the rest of my life?
What's the difference in laugh count between those two shows? Like, would you be getting a lot of laughs out of this isn't working, this or this could go wrong?
Good question. Really good question. I think, yes, the danger is you get really good at struggling. Like, you learn to be funny when you're like, oh, I don't know. You know, you could always, you know, the sorts of acts who they're like, I remember that, I won't name him, but there was this one Road Warrior act years ago who his gear about how badly it was going was way better than his gear.
Yeah.
And you just go, oh, this is because you've died so hard so many times with your not very good gear that you've learned to fail really well.
Yeah.
So the danger is, yes, absolutely. I clocked that. I was like, am I just learning to get out of it? But I don't think I was. What I was trying to do was stay in the moment, go, what do I really think about this? I had a story about... there was a particular story about going camping with some friends, and I was sure there was something funny about it. And so I would tell it, and then whilst I was telling it, I would try to stay in it, and I would cheap out of it with a gag, and then they'd laugh, and I'd go, and I'd say out loud, "Stop, that's bullshit. You're just laughing because I got out of that cheaply with rhythm or with an arbitrary callback or something. Why am I here talking about this?" And I'd take a breath, and I'd go, okay, what did it mean to me? It meant that I was proud. I was really proud, or whatever the thing was, you know. And I try and actually find it live on stage. Now, those bits aren't always funny, but they are always interesting. And I think there's a lot of funny out there, and I'm sometimes a bit bored of funny, 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 funny. I would rather... Patton Oswalt says this thing about how you should put the moment of realization into your story. If you're telling a story or, you know, a bit about something, don't tell it from the perspective of someone who has realised something because of these things happened. Put that moment of realisation. You know his story. I don't know how familiar you are with Patton's stuff, but he's got a story about buying Lean Cuisines in a convenience store, and then Africa by Toto comes on the whatever it's called, the intercom, the PA, and that's it. That's the plot of the, that's everything that happens. But he tells it whereby he realizes the serenity. He could just have killed himself. Like it's an incredible bit. He's looking at Lean Cuisines and summing up the relative calorific content and how the different Lean Cuisines that he's forced to eat are tasting. And he says, Africa by Toto comes on. And if he'd had a gun, then it would have been like, meatball ragu, dun, 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 and just slid the gun into his mouth. Like, do you know what I mean? So that moment is right in the... the bit. So I'm trying in a pathetic way to kind of ape that sort of moment of like trying to focus less on plot and more on what is this, like, what am I feeling and what's the truth of it and what does it mean to me? Because there must be a reason why I want to tell that story on stage. I'm not just telling it because I've got nothing. Sometimes I am. But anything I've selected, if I've got nothing and gone, oh, I could do that, then there is a reason why I think I could do that. There's something interesting or potentially funny about it. Sorry, I've been speaking for a long time.
No, it's really interesting. So what did you discover then? What did you decide?
Oh, it doesn't work and I'm bad at it. No. I suppose I discovered that I can have a lot more confidence in myself. You know, that I'm maybe part one, maybe step one of the journey to becoming, I'd hope I'm on step seven at least, by now, 15 years in. But maybe if the ultimate goal is to be one of those people where everything you say is funny, maybe part of that, maybe one of my biggest obstacles is a sort of deeply held core belief that I'm not really a comedian, I'm not really funny, I don't deserve to be there, I don't have funny bones, all of that stuff. I was going to say shit, and I was like, I'm not saying none of it's true, you know. But it's deeply, it's like it's laced into my bones. And so for me, just taking a step towards, even just knowing that's the goal, I want to just be funny. I don't want to have...
Yeah.
I don't want to be the guy who can write a brilliantly crafted routine every year. I mean, that's sure. That'd be great. But I don't... That's... You know, I tried to do that for a long time and I don't think that's me. I want to be one of those people that just kind of goes... And it just kind of... But that's what I've got. That's the only... That's the only really good thing I've got. That's the only bit of talent I think I've got. Is sometimes I can relax the sort of joke sphincter, you know, and just it just comes out somehow. So I'm trying to put myself in that mode as efficiently as possible. So
what did you do for your tour then? Like, did you actually go for it in, did you do Primer as your tour?
I did a few bits of it. I'd done it very little.
So mixed it in.
Yeah, what I started doing about 3 years ago, I started doing a thing called Hell Week. Basically, when I realised that I needed to write an hour of comedy every year, and I've done like 9 or 10 now, I felt like I had homework for the rest of my life. I was like, oh God, you know, I'm like free, I'm a comedian, everything's great, I'm making money, it's all great.
I'm on all the time because I know I can't switch off.
Yes.
Because I won't come up with enough stuff.
You've got to always be cranking it out. Now that to me felt like a shit way to live your life. Right. Mm. And we might be discovering what I'm...
My girlfriend thinks so.
Yeah. Yeah. No one ever talks about... Here's my thing. No one ever talks about creative efficiency. We've all got this preconception that you're supposed to cut your ear off alone in a garret because your work is making you so depressed. You know, and I want to be happy. I want to be a happy artist. I don't want to. It's not worth it to me. I've been depressed. I've had terrible anxiety in, you know, periods in my life. My mental health's a roller coaster at the best of times. I don't want to have to feel bad for my job. I want to feel good and do my job. So, and doing my own podcast has made me realize through talking to hundreds and hundreds of comedians, there is no, you don't have to be depressed. You know, a lot of us worry about stuff, but so I thought, I want to be a happy artist. I want to learn a way to do this that doesn't feel like I've got this weight hanging over my, oh God, I've got to go to work. What's the point of that? We are given this gift to have this incredible lifestyle. Musicians can't do this. You can't be a session musician like a session comic like we can. You know, what a treat. So, I mean, you can be those things, but it's fucking hard. You know, it's easier for us to make a living from it. I didn't want to squander that. So I wanted to be happy and I wanted to be efficient, because if I feel like I can, this is a very long way around. Basically, I used to feel like September the 1st, that's when I start writing next year's show and going back into the mode of it. So when is the fun bit of the year? You only get a fun July when you're tweaking, you know, bullshit. Mm. So then I started doing a thing called Hell Week, where I'd go, right, I'm gonna test myself. I'm not going to do any writing until the, whatever it was, 10th of November. And then I'm going to do an hour and I'm going to write it that morning. I booked like a week of gigs at the Bill Murray, and I said, I'm going to write all day and then do it that night. And then I'm going to rewrite it all day and do it that night. And then I can put all the depression and self-loathing into 1 week, and that'll be more efficient.
And so if something sort of works, so the first day you do it, if a bit you think, oh, there's something there, but it didn't quite work, would you pass it on to the next day to develop it?
Or yes,
would
you just absolutely, because I had, I had nothing else.
So each day you take the best bits from the previous day and then add bits.
Yes.
Okay.
Cool. And as a result, because I am not famous these days, I have a bit of a following of people who'll turn up. Mm. But in those days, like it was sort of 4 or 5 years ago, I really have such a debt of gratitude to the Neil Peterses of this world, the Jose Vizcadios, the Kate Websters, the Andy McAfees, the super fans who go to everything. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. And you just go, oh, it's you. You've seen this 4 times. Do you know what I mean? The people who are like, okay, I'm a huge comedy person. And there are loads of other names I should say that I've forgotten. My point was, I haven't forgotten that. My point is, I just got to sit here and listen. Yeah, yeah. There's loads of other people I don't care about. Out. Yeah, yeah.
I just have you going,
yeah, but some others.
Come on, I remember all my fans.
So doing dog shit, shocking, bad comedy to willing, helpful people who are like willing me to succeed. So I did that. And then the year, so 2018, September 2018, I went, right, I'm going to do a new thing. I'm not going to do a show next year. I'm going to do new material. And I'm not going to write anything until Leicester Comedy Festival. So on the 22nd of February, I did a show at Leicester, and I said the blurb, I said, my guarantee is that I will not have written a word of this show until the morning of the performance, right? Because I wanted them to know that what they were getting into.
No one came. That's weird.
Yeah. Well, that's it. I had 50 people in a room, and I went out and I got there and I sat in a cafe across the road from the venue, and I had 4 mad hours. And listen, I didn't write any jokes. Right? The adrenaline was there. Adrenaline can be useful. There is that super brain thing. Yeah, is that? I don't know. I mean,
no.
It's not so much adrenaline as focus. There's a deadline. They're physically there. You're not just thinking, I'll get around to some jokes, I suppose. It's a bit like it's the sort of methadone version of the heroin of being on stage.
Yeah.
That's a bad example because heroin makes you go to sleep. It's a, I can't think of the, so it's like the PCP of being on stage. There's a mini version of that which doesn't exist as far as I'm aware. It's, I tell you what it is. It's, if on stage is Red Bull, then that is sort of, half an espresso or something. No, that's worse. I don't know what the fuck. God, and you can tell all this. It's made me so funny. I'm just brilliant. as I fucking plough my way through a shit metaphor. The point
this is live working.
It's not
comedy, just how to talk.
Just how to talk. So I had that crazy 4 hours, and then I did something, and you know, 3 bits of it turned into bits, and a lot of it was me going, fuck, here we go. Here we go. Okay, what about this? Yeah. Anything? No, because this. No, really nothing. Sure. Next bit. Yeah. You know, but three bits turned into bits.
So with this podcast, like so you've got a lot of stuff that you've tried and got rid of. Are there any bits that you really liked and you're like, oh, it's such a shame that bit never worked?
I'm going to look at my notes for this. This is Primer. This was, my notes tell me this is edition 13 of Primer. So, so that bit, by that time, the beginning bit was working. I've got to try and remember what it is. Syncope. Syncope never worked. Syncope is a thing where it's a medical thing whereby old men get up in the middle of the night to go for a wee and they pass out because their blood pressure is so low. Right. So you get up in the middle of the night. In the middle of the night, you're asleep. Your blood pressure is very low. If you then urinate, it can lower your blood pressure even further and you can literally pass out. So that happened to me. And on holiday, I went for a wee in the middle of the night and I just literally passed out, keeled over backwards, like prone, and hit the side of my head as I fell on, you know, the lip at the bottom of a shower. You know, the bit that stops the shower water running out? So that ridge, like that sideways plank, I smashed the side of my head on that, knocked myself out cold.
So and already then, I'm thinking, I could see why this might not work, because you're like, that's horrible if they like you as a performer.
Yes, well, that is one of the crosses I bear. They really like me. So anything in which I, anything bad that happens to me, has to be really sugar-coated because otherwise they don't, if I talk about depression or anger or something, they're like, oh, but Stu, you're okay, right? You know, in a way that they probably don't even know they're doing, but that's my reading of it. So there's that. But I think it's funny that a terrible thing happened to me, and it's funny that it's supposed to only happen to old men. Like, says something about me. I'm 42, and so that's a worry that I'm getting old. So there's something there. Mm. I don't know that I ever managed to find what was interesting to me about it. But then equally, I probably never even gave it that good of a run out, because by then I was having a brilliant Edinburgh and having loads of fun. So I didn't really get to... I tell you what, I put it in, I can tell you now, I put it inside a bit about... this went nowhere either. So being a collaborator, being eager to please, meaning, because I'm eager to please, but who? Like, the idea of that bit was... Oh, I'm the sort of person, I naturally help someone carry a bag up the stairs. I naturally help an old lady across the road. But my point is, like, that's not necessarily good, because the same instinct is what makes people collaborators with occupying forces. Do you know what I mean? It's like, I'm eager to please an old lady, my parents, the government, the Chinese government. Do you know what I mean? It's like there's something in that. So I talked about that. I talked about how, like, we all like to say to ourselves, my granddad would have stood up to the Nazis. He would never have, like, that. Whereas I worry that my grandchildren will go, oh, Grandpa Stu, he'd have folded like that. Do you know what I mean? And then I did kind of an act out.
He just passed out on the toilet floor.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, well, something structural like that would have really helped. As it was, I did an act out of me sort of answering. It became clear during the act out, it was just mime, where I was answering the door and kind of going, no, no, like looking around bewildered, no. And then sort of pointing under the floor in a sort of, you know, like Inglourious Bastard, like, I've got no idea. Sorry. Again, I'm conjuring a huge thing. The idea of collaboration with the Nazis, it's far too big of a thing to see in the perspective of, like, I haven't earned that comparison. It's too shocking and painful a thing. But the act out was funny. Act outs are a very creative space for me. I'll invent three jokes inside an act out because I'll lose myself. And so the chattering monkey that tells me I'm shit and can't do it disappears because I'm just lost in a silly thing.
Was working, what made you why wouldn't you keep running with that as a bit?
Honestly, I'm gonna sound like such a prick, so much stuff was working. I mean, not I don't mean so much stuff was gold, but so much stuff had at least that bit of goodness, at least that much good inside it. I then kind of ended up in a bit that I think the place that bit led me to was a bit about my emotions being really up and down, which is now a very solid bit that I'm doing. I was at the Cape Town Comedy Festival and was hosting the show every night in this huge venue. And I really started, just before the pandemic, I really started to, like, take risks in act outs in a big room in front of lots of people. That was really so much fun. So it's a bit about, and that's in the new show, which is on sort of semi-permanent stasis. Who knows if they'll even be in Edinburgh next year, and then everyone's shit will be really irrelevant. But fortunately, I've been writing about thought processes rather than current events. So it might be a bit more, it might have more longevity. But the bit is about being in the bank and the way that I'm furious with the system, the bank system, because it's not... moving fast enough, the system's broken, I'm furious but I don't admit it. And then but when someone in the queue in front of me flips out and goes, for fuck's sake, what are you doing? I do a 180 and I'm like, hey, come on, man, relax. And
Chill out.
Exactly. Like, and it's so hypocritical. But then what I'm doing is like a huge, I'm doing like a 2-minute act out of this guy gradually sliding down the back wall of the venue going, relax, baby. It's all, everyone's got to be somewhere. I mean, what is money, right? You know, so I really draw that out.
I like the idea of you getting your phone out and start recording it.
Well, you see, that's a nice idea. Do you mean, just to be clear about the joke, you mean like,
yeah,
like that emphasizes the hypocriticalness of look at this prick. I wouldn't do that. I don't think I would do that as a bit because it wouldn't occur to me to do that.
Because it's not true.
Because it's not true. It's partly because it's not true, and I'm not Mr. Truth on stage. I try to be, and I flatter myself that I am, but it's more that the spirit of it isn't a thing that I would do, so I'm not interested in pursuing it. To me, that bit is about what a trifling, hypocritical dick I am. And I tell you what it is. My instinct is not to pile the pressure on the person. My instinct is to pile the pressure on me. If I film it, then I win the situation. And I don't want to win the situation. Yeah. I want to be reduced to a blubbering pool of piss. And you can quote me on that.
So did that bit work?
Yes.
As a bit. So that's the bit that you were experimenting
with. Working,
and
now that bit is lengthening. There's now, I'm populating the bank. I'm populating the cashiers in the bank. They're doing things. They're having a relationship with each other. I can put more people in the queue. I can build on that because I know it ends on a really big dumb act out that I cannot wait to do because it, touch wood, always works.
Yeah. So with the act out, are you saying that like you were experimenting with a huge audience? So like when I do gags like to a massive like 1,000+, I love that because with what I do you get
at least one of them will laugh.
Exactly. But at least one of them will get it first, and then it, because say 50% get it straight away, and then the wave spreads, and that's for me, because I think I always say like, oh, my stuff works better to loads of people, but then everyone's stuff does. But the technical side, it's beautiful. I like that. because people that are slower, can catch up, and then everyone's enjoying it, right?
Totally.
So with the act out, is it easier in that same sense to act out with more people because you can? There's more people to get on board at different points, or does it make a difference between the
it's
big?
It's a good
cause
question.
If you then went down to a small audience now, is there a risk that it wouldn't work quite the same?
I suppose there is, but it would need to be small. It would need to be less than 50, I think, to make a real difference. Because if the bit is funny, like in the same way as you, because I don't really do short jokes. I've written like 5 short jokes in my life. And I love them, but I just find them impossible to write. They fall out of the sky or they don't for me. And that's not true, actually. My best short joke I ever wrote, I really put a lot of work into, and it worked, and it did me great for 10 years. So if I just put that work into everything, you would think that I would end up with some, do you know what I mean, with some really good gear. But that's just not what my.
But this is why I'm on all the time, because I can't, because it's not that easy, is it? So it's hour of them every year.
Totally. My work ethic is, I was talking to Alice Fraser about this yesterday, my work ethic is work really hard now in order so that I can be as lazy as I want to later. Like my whole work ethic is designed to make things, like I said, creative efficiency. It's designed to mean I don't have to work for a living. I'm the tail end of people who started doing comedy as a sort of alternative lifestyle fuck about. I'm pre-ambition. Do you know what I mean? I was on the cusp, you know? Yeah. So my whole thing was like, I want to have a crazy fun life and have a laugh and, do you know what I mean? Like to have adventures and stuff. And now I've got children. I just want to hang out with my children the whole time. I don't want to be a bad artist because of it, but I want to learn to be an efficient artist with my creativity and with my time such that I can spend my life on a beach eating ice cream. I don't do any of those things. But so just before we got onto short jokes, I had something else to say. You were asking whether...
smaller audience?
Smaller audiences out? Made a difference, yes. So... I think the point I wanted to make is that you get to recognize the ripple because the type of comedy you do is short, brilliant jokes. And so you do one, you ripple it out like this while you rack up your next one. I don't work like that. I work like jump into the swimming pool and flounder about. So I have a deep connection to them, I don't think I have as much time to relish the reaction, because what I'm trying to be inside myself, kind of lose. I want to lose myself in it. That's the difference. I want to lose myself in it, and I can only do that if it's working. If it isn't working, then once in a blue moon, I will manage to lose myself inside it, and that will make it work again. So I don't get so much. I do sometimes get time. I said I don't do prop stuff. There was one gag I did with the screen that I was using where it would be, the joke was, I would do a thing. I'd do a bit or ask, I wouldn't even ask a question. And someone in a room of 50, 60 people would always chip in with something that sounded funny. And that would get a big laugh. And then I would hit a button and it would reveal that I had predicted they'd do that. I consider that a really cheap as chips kind of a gag. Like, that's the sort of thing I'll see someone, I won't name any names, but I'll see someone do that in a big venue and it'll kill. Yeah. And I'll roll my eyes like, oh, come on, mate, that's just a trick. But I did it. And honestly, because I recorded all of them and listened back to them, I know that one time it got a laugh for 29 seconds. 29 seconds. This laugh built and built and exploded and broke and built. It was just magic. And I'm like, oh, that's why I use tricks in it. That's good. so that on rare occasions, I would get to stand there looking at them. But still, even then, I would be staying in the attitude of the bit. But I'd just be looking out from inside the bit, looking at them being both things at once, being the person I'm playing inside the bit and the architect of this huge fucking laugh. Ha ha ha, aren't I clever? Look at you. Yes, fill me with your love. You know, that sort of thing. But normally I'm aiming to lose myself.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
We're pretty much near the end of the time. Have you got any other bits? Oh,
Jesus, I'm sorry. I do bang on.
No, this is great, man. This is spot on. It's lovely. Have you got any other little bits that you could...
Little bits. Let me just look back at the thing. I'd like to find something I gave up on.
What was one of the short jokes that you had, that you've written in your five short jokes?
It's an older thing. Yeah,
you actually did them on set. You like they were in your old set, were they?
Oh yeah. God, yeah, for years. I mean, one of them turned up in three shows, but it's only like 8 seconds long. But and I used to open with it for ages. I used to open with something about. I used to say I'm a metrosexual. That means I'll sleep with anyone I've met. and I say I do mean anyone. I mean, it was a daft little thing, but it was a setup for this. I said I do mean anyone. I'm not on the other bus, but I will catch it home rather than walk. Right? And that, you know, that's a proper joke. Like, you could have written that. Great. You know, that's a good joke. Well, exactly, yeah. So, like, the expression, I'm not on the other bus, so it's a joke about who I am and my sexuality. And the fact that, you're absolutely right, there's two jokes in there. There's the metaphor, the analogy of the bus, and there's what the analogy of the bus means. So people catch on at different times, like... you know, I'm a bit bisexual, but it's basically just because I'm easy and I'm desperate to go home with someone. Do you know what I mean? That's sort of what the thing is. And that was the That did me for... I use that a lot. I use that a lot. You know, I'd be doing some sitcom warm-up and I'd be like, I've got that in my back pocket for hour three when they want to leave. And so I use that for a long time. What I open with now is... Well, no, I've got to retire this now, but it's done me well for a couple of years, is talking about... And the reason I want to mention this is because it's character-driven. And what helps for me... It'd be lovely to turn this sentiment into a joke. But the problem I have when I walk on stage is that I look like a boring winner, right? I look like a person who has no need to be on stage because I look nice, I sound nice, and I'm not saying that I look successful inherently, but I look blandly handsome, right? So, you know, handsome, so who gives a fuck about this handsome guy? But blandly, so double who gives a fuck about him, right? Mm-hmm. So I say, I mean, it'd be weird. I'm assuming that anyone listening to this is deeply embedded enough in the craft of comedy that you can hear someone say that about themselves in a purely amoral, this is what I've learned from...
This is all I'm leaving in, mate.
This is the whole episode, yeah.
Yeah.
I think I look like a boring winner, and I think they think I look like a boring winner. So if I walk on, and if I'm fast enough knocking my own perceived status, they warm to me.
Mm.
They accept me. They don't feel condescended to. So I could never play Liverpool to my satisfaction. I could only ever get away with a gig in Liverpool. And I learnt to... I mean, by my standards, I would be fine. Yeah, and I was worth paying and please continue to book me. But the last time I did that lovely... Have you done that hot water, the Octo gig? You open and close two different rooms for two nights. So you do eight shows.
Yeah.
And I was like, well, I've got to nail this. And on the second show, I nailed it because I found a way to let them, and this, I find this particularly in the Northwest. Who told me this? I can't remember. Was it? I can't remember. Do you know who it was? It was lovely. Danny McLaughlin.
Okay, great. Yeah.
Danny told me this. He said they're not, I was kind of bitching about the fact like, fuck, they just hate me because I'm not from around here and I don't have gear from where I'm from because I'm not from anywhere interesting. And Danny said, they don't hate you. They're just scared that you're going to condescend to them. And I was like, oh, God, that's good. So what I learned was, rather than, you know, that classic thing in Liverpool, you've got to, I don't know who said this, you've got to wank them off for a bit before you start. Do you know what I mean?
That's I missed that. Sorry, it paused.
No worries. It'll come out on the audio, but I'll say it again. Anyway. Yeah. You've got to wank them off for a bit, right? That's not what I'm saying. That's what's been said to me.
That's such a weird bit to pause. It's like Zoom. No, that was what you're going to say. And they've had so many people wanking that they're just cutting it out.
It just cuts out them from the word. So that's not my sentiment. But people, what I mean is, as an actor who's from the generic South, the Midlands, but as far as they're concerned, the generic South, if they're concerned that I'm going to condescend to them, the shabby way out of that is to walk on and go, it's great to be here. This is the best city in the world. And they all cheer and they go, fine, he's not a dick. But that's kind of, you know, they deserve more than that. You don't need to go on and literally wank them off. So so what I started doing, sort of almost by accident, almost out of sort of resignation to like, I don't know what to do with this very crucial little 30 seconds of my set. On the second gig of the Hot Water Octo gig, I walked on and I said, well, it's great to be here. Before I go any further, obviously I'm not from round here, but I just want to tell you that Liverpool is the greatest city in the world. And I said it like that. And they sort of cheered weakly because they could tell I didn't really mean it. And all the people who kind of bought it, who took it at face value, cheered weakly. And I went, sure. Do you know what I mean? And that that established the status. Like, I'm doing that because you have made me have to reduce myself to that because you are pathetic for thinking it, right? High risk, never went wrong over the whole weekend. It was great fun.
Yeah.
In fact, I've misdescribed that. What I did was I said, so I'm from London and there'd be a boo or something. And I'd say, I think it's a great city. Obviously, it's not as good as Liverpool. Then they'd cheer and then I'd go, sure. I've kind of misquoted you a bit, but that was great. The bit. That now works.
I actually did that as well, but not that. Not I didn't have a joke. So I had this exact same problem when they used to do Baby Blue, Comedy Central, whatever it was called in the end. Yeah. And I'd say... where I'm from, and then I can't remember exactly how I did it, but I said I went to university in Liverpool, and I didn't.
Yeah.
And it's so great to be back. And that always got them on board, and the gigs from then always worked.
Yeah.
Just established, I'm from down south, but I actually like it up here. That was all it is.
That's all it is. And yeah. it's a pathetic lie that you were reduced to telling, and you should have come up with a better joke. But that's, you know.
Yeah. But I learned
I say that as someone
in...
who's also lied pathetically.
But in Manchester, I did go to uni in Manchester, and I noticed that when I told them that in Manchester, it just as a into a first bit, that worked in Manchester. So I was like, oh well, if that works here, that was a technique, it'll work anywhere. And so when I did, well, I just tried it in Liverpool, and the gig just went amazing. So
yeah. Listen, and I think that's what Danny has put his finger on it there. Is that the expression? Put your finger on something. Put your finger on its head. It's not that you need to flatter them. You just need them to know you're not going to condescend to them. And I don't mean this specifically about Liverpool. I think the North, if you're an act from the generic South, they just have been talked down to by Southerners. People who've turned up and done gigs about the Tube or gone, oh, it's grim up here or whatever. That psychically resonates with the whole audience. And you just need to be able to say, in a way that isn't saying this, look, I'm cool. Don't worry about it. I'm not the man. I'm not the Southern man, you know? So just sort of affirming that, I think, is really important. I was going to say something else on that, which is to do with opening lines that they would know. Oh, sorry. What a clean edit it was up until here. It was something about, it wasn't about Danny. It was something about Liverpool, Northern. Can't remember.
No. Fair enough. Don't worry.
I did a terrible podcast guest thing there of just being silent. So you'll sort of have to cut that bit.
That's right. I've got to produce it.
Pod hacking.
It's fine. He'd be loving this one because there's not much to edit at all.
I tell you what, I always think editors deserve a lot of respect. That is a toadying move to make sure he treats me well. Yeah. I did that when I did. Did you ever see that show Me the Funny? About 10 years ago, it was like a reality show. The one that Monaghan won.
I remember it.
The edit treated me well. I had a horrible time on the show. I did really well at some of the gigs. Two of the gigs I did really well at. And I just hated the format. I liked the people. I liked some of the acts. And I liked almost all of the producers. But I couldn't get over the fact that they were sort of pretending it wasn't reality telly. And I was incredibly cynical from day one. But everyone else seemed so blithely kind of... It's almost like someone goes, oh, don't worry, we're not going to try and make you look bad. And so all the other acts relaxed. And I was like, but of course they'd say that, right? That, you know. So I felt very tense throughout the whole thing. But Oh, fuck's sake, what was my point? Oh, that was it. I think part of the reason the edit treated me well is that every so often when we were on a long, boring location thing, knowing that the editors would have to sit and watch literally everything that went into every camera, I used to, whenever the camera was on me, I'd look into the barrel and go, do you know who I really respect? TV editors. And I just thought you'd give them a little giggle in their editing suite somewhere months later. And I think maybe it worked. Maybe that's why they were kind.
Great. But interestingly, that format for that show isn't dissimilar to you doing different stuff every gig, is it? Because wasn't it you go to a different place and do stuff about the place?
Thank you, that's a lovely connection, Mark. Yes, because it was pitched to us as you're going to go to a weird and wonderful place, some different environment for summer. I don't think I ever said this, but in my mind I was like, maybe we'll go on a submarine. Do you know what I mean? I was like, we're going to go somewhere nuts, and then you're going to write stuff about that place and perform it to the people in that place. And I was terrified of that. And as soon as I realised I was terrified of it, I sort of, in the back of my mind, I started going, I've got to at least try. Otherwise, sort of a coward, you know, because I clearly am. And like, that's, if imagine doing that and succeeding at it. That's like training, you know, punching, you know, meat in the back of a van or whatever, to use an obvious analogy. So that's what attracted me to it. And then, of course, it wasn't that. It wasn't really that. It was... You know, it was TV world, and it's mostly being interviewed and mostly getting out of a taxi for a ninth time so they can get the shot whilst you're shitting yourself because you're about to do material you've never done before and you haven't written yet 24 hours from now on TV in front of potentially millions of people and in front of TV judges who are comedians who are going to judge you when they personally themselves would never dream of doing a 7-minute news set.
That part.
Yeah, they would judge you. And they would, you know, Alan Davies was lovely. Kate Copstick was, you know, she was gunning for her, you know, I want to be the Simon Cowell of the comedy world thing, and doing very well. She was, some of the stuff she said was very, very funny and insightful, and mean. And I mean, God, I'll tell you off mic, a thing she said about someone that thank God got cut because it was a career ending thing she said. It was awful. It was vicious, not entirely inaccurate. But So, but you had to do it in front of comics who would not drink. Cannon and Ball were the guests judges on the episode that I got kicked out on. And Bobby Ball, bless him, was like, I like you. I like you. He said it 11 times. I do. I like you. And is it Bobby Ball? And then Tommy Cannon was sort of said he wasn't really into what I was doing. And I was just thinking, are you having a laugh? Would you ever write 7 minutes of new material and do it untested? Why are we all pretending that that isn't the most heroic challenge you've ever heard of?
And why are they judging that?
I know. Well, the whole, because it was reality telly and they kind of, it was ITV. Yeah. It was ITV. Yeah, I should have run a mile. But I was, but that is precisely why I was attracted to that show, because I thought it was going to be like this. It was billed as MasterChef for comics. And on day one, I went, oh, this is X Factor, isn't it? You liars.
Yeah. Oh, cool, man.
Yeah. Lovely. Anyway, sorry, I get on my high horse about that all the time.
No, man, that's great. That's gold, mate. That is really cool.
Thank you. I've enjoyed this a lot. It's been really good fun.
What I will do is I'll send you my email address if you could chuck me like a wee transfer.
Yes, of course. I will do that. And also, do you mind? Can I plug something?
Oh yeah, go for it.
Is that right? The thing I wanted to plug is just I've been, since the pandemic, I have been pivoting wildly and trying to create, you know, other things to do online, as well as an online chat show I'm doing called The Infinite Sofa, which your listeners can find out about at infinitesofa.com. And I hope you're going to be my guest soon. We're sort of talking about a date at the moment. But I'm also doing a thing that might interest people who listen to this podcast. It's called Working Lunch, and you can find out about it at comedianscomedian.com/lunch. And it's kind of mentoring coaching sessions over Zoom with newer comics. And I'm not directing anyone and I'm not writing jokes for anyone. But what I'm trying to do is some of the sorts of things we've been talking about. I'm trying to sort of help people overcome creative blocks in their own comedy. Like a thing that happens quite often. I've done 7 or 8 of them now. They've been really, really good fun. And I've got some lovely feedback on them from the acts. But the sorts of things people are, that comes up a lot, are people do a bit or send me a video and I go, okay, that joke. And then they go, I'm really sort of embarrassed to be doing that. And I'm like, well, why are you doing it?
Yes.
And we get into that. We get into those sorts of things. So if people are listening to this because they love the craft, it might be that they would enjoy a conversation like that. So you can find out about that at comedianscomedian.com/.
Stuart Goldsmith! Hashtag Awooga! Hashtag Awooga, Stuart Goldsmith, thank you for joining me and sort of joining you as well, Joel, isn't it?
In a way.
Sort of, in a way. Great stuff. Any feedback for the episodes, as always, on social media at Jokes with Mark across the board. Anything else, Joel?
Nothing from me, Mark. Anything from you, Mark?
It was a bit abrupt, but no. Nothing more from me, Joel. Hashtag Awooga, everybody.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do and start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia. Movement that inspires.
Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year, 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year, 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.